from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Russia and China will be deepening their strategic and military cooperation. That, according to China's defense minister, Chang Wanquan, as he sat down to work with Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, at bilateral talks outside the 4th Moscow International Conference on Security. Minister Chang told journalists Thursday that Russia and China are strategic partners and that the relationship between the states and their armed forces is developing at a high level. He told reporters that the talks with his Russian counterpart were an exchange of views on the regional and global situation, as well as on other matters of common interest, adding, quote, "We have worked out a wide range of agreements," closed quote. Meanwhile, Russia is apparently accelerating its pivot to Asia in earnest this week. While Moscow's foreign and defense ministers were meeting with their counterparts from Beijing, Russia's prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev, made a landmark trip to Vietnam and Thailand. We'll have more on that later in this newscast. Another 33 people were killed by Saudi airstrikes Thursday that also took out a bridge and a gas station in the closing hours of the third straight week of Riyadh's aerial campaign against Yemen. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
Well, Saudi warplanes continue pounding Yemen for the 21st consecutive day as the death toll from the aggression there mounts. The latest airstrikes hit a bridge and a gas station in Houthi district in Amran province. The bombardment left at least 20 people dead. Saudi warplanes also targeted the Bani Sarim directorate in the province. Earlier, Saudi fighter jets bombarded a school in Malahid region near the Saudi-Yemeni border. 8 people, including a mother and her 3 children, were killed in Sada. The United Nations has called for an investigation into the high number of civilian casualties in Yemen. Nearly 2,600 people have been killed since the Saudi offensive against Yemen began on March the 26th. To discuss that further, we're now joined by Professor Lawrence Davidson, who is a professor at Westchester University, and he is joining us live now via Skype from Pennsylvania. Professor, as always, thanks for joining us. You know, Professor, social media is full now of this talk of civilian casualties. Apparently, civilians were killed even waiting for petrol at a petrol station, being targeted by Saudi-led airstrikes, while the Saudis say that they're not targeting civilians. So who are we meant to believe here?
The dead people on the street. That's who you believe. I think that the Saudis have run out of military targets. And therefore, they don't know essentially what to do, except to pick and choose around opportunistic, essentially go after opportunistic targets, like gas stations and government buildings or something like that, and apparently schools. But I think that this is a sign that essentially the Saudis and their allies kind of don't know where to go from here. The logical next step for them would to be to mount a ground invasion. However, it seems to me that they're having serious second thoughts about that, because I don't think that they think they can achieve a very clean and quick victory. So essentially, it's a stalling action and a stalling period, because they don't know what the next step should be. And in the meantime, they just kill civilians.
And yet, Professor, the confusing part, obviously, in all this is the United States continues to stand by the Saudis, and so does the UK, providing the kingdom with arms throughout this.
Right. Well, I think that in terms of the United States, there's a feeling that we owe the Saudis something in exchange for our having made this agreement with Iran. And so we do this. We support the Saudis, at least in a minimal fashion. Though I've said before, what the Saudis are doing in Yemen is not in the U.S. interests, at least not as the U.S. understands its interests. and as it understands its interest, is to go after al-Qaeda and its allies. That's what it was doing in Yemen. And the Saudis, with their attack, essentially forced the Americans to retreat out, to disband their drone attacks and their drone program in Yemen. And essentially, then the Saudis created this chaos and this vacuum, power vacuum, and civil war and what have you. And that's, of course, an environment in which al-Qaeda thrives. So this is what's going on, is not in the American interests as they understand it, but the U.S. goes along with it because, one, it can't stop it, and two, we seem to feel that we owe, in some weird way, we owe the Saudis one because of the deal we made with Iran.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has warned that millions of Yemenis face food insecurity amid the Saudis' ongoing deadly airstrikes against the country. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli has more.
The UN agency says nearly 11 million people in Yemen are severely food insecure, and millions more at risk of being unable to meet their basic needs. The agency also called for $8 million in funding to support farmers amid the escalating crisis. According to the UN body's latest assessment, increasing conflict in nearly all major towns across the country is disrupting markets and trade and driving up local food prices. It's also hampering agricultural production, including land preparation and planting for the 2015 harvests. The warning comes as Saudi Arabia remains defiant to international calls to halt its airstrikes in Yemen. Riyadh does not even allow for a safe passage of aid to be delivered to Yemenis. Well, for more on this, let's go to London and talk to Professor Rodney Shakespeare, political analyst. Mr. Shakespeare, first of all, why can't the United Nations do anything to create a pause in the airstrikes for both humanitarian aid and food to reach the people of Yemen?
Because the United States and its allies are all hand in glove with the axis of evil, which is Israel, and in this case, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is conducting a creeping genocide, very similar to that of the one by which Israel attacked Gaza. You start with a military attack, making sure you hit civilians, you destroy the water supplies and the sewage supplies, and then you put a black blockade on. And that is what is going on now in Yemen. You are having 11 million people who essentially are going to be attacked, blockaded, and essentially starved. This is the axis of evil, the USA, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, with the Americans claiming that Saudi Arabia is supporting democracy. The whole thing is disgusting.
And it's annoying to see that Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen without any mandate from the United Nations. Just how likely will Saudi Arabia be held accountable for killing innocent civilians who have not taken part in the war, which potentially means a war crime?
Well, exactly. You are back to the Americans. So quite whether anyone will ever get these people for what are atrocious war crimes, the same sort of thing that Israel does, is a question. It's ultimately about...
And as a professor of economics, I'd like to have your view on the on Yemen's economy. I mean, Yemen is a poor country to begin with. Now, in light of this Saudi aggression against the country, what kind of an economy are we going to expect in the near future?
The country is essentially dependent on an agriculture at the moment, and the agricultural season is going to be wrecked. Medical supplies are not being able to be brought in because of this blockade. So we're going to get the population in three ways. Destroying the water, destroying the bridges, destroying the sewage on the one hand, destroying the agricultural system, season, and then lastly, stopping things like medical supplies. It is a form of creeping genocide, which the Americans, hand in glove with the Israelis, are very good at.
The Yemeni people themselves were also heard from in their own voices Thursday, as thousands once again took to the streets of the capital Sana'a to protest the deadly Saudi invasion of their impoverished Arab country. Press TV's Kanaiz Fatima has more.
Allahu Akbar! The protesters chanted, Saudi is Israel's ally and victory is for Islam. They called on the international community to end what they described as Saudi's barbaric aggression. The demonstrators condemned the UN Security Council for approving an arms embargo on Ansarullah fighters. They issued a statement stressing the continuation of the popular mobilization against the aggression and demanded an urgent international probe into Saudi crimes. On Thursday alone, 33 people were killed in Saudi airstrikes on the town of Houth in Sana'a province. Saudi Arabia started the invasion on March the 26th without a UN mandate in a bid to restore fugitive former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Over 2,600 Yemenis have lost their lives in the offensive. Iran's Defense Minister Hossein Dehghan says Saudi Arabia invaded Yemen following a nod from the United States and Israel. Dehghan said Yemen is facing joint aggression from Saudi Arabia, the U.S. and Israel, who have failed in their schemes to stop the Yemeni people's revolution. He warned Saudi leaders that the war will pave the way for the disintegration of their own countries. Dehghan condemned Riyadh for the massacre of civilians and the heavy destruction of infrastructure in Yemen. He likened the aggression to Israel's onslaught on the Gaza Strip. The Iranian minister said sponsors of the ISIL and other Takfiri terrorists have failed to achieve their goals in Iraq and Syria. He added that they are planning to reorganize the terrorist groups and move them to Afghanistan, the Caucasus, Central Asia, India, Western China, and even Europe. Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov has criticized the U.S. for encouraging the Saudi invasion of Yemen. Lavrov made the comment at the Moscow International Security Conference on Thursday. He said Washington demonstrates double standards by supporting the war on Yemen and helping organize last year's anti-constitutional coup in Ukraine. He also warned about attempts to artificially escalate the Sunni-Shia confrontations in order to achieve political goals. Saudi Arabia's military aggression against Yemen started without a UN mandate on March the 26th. The assault has claimed the lives of 2,600 people so far.
Two students from a military academy were killed and six others wounded in a bomb attack in Egypt. The attack took place north of Cairo. For nearly 2 years, Egypt has been battling terrorists based in the Sinai. Recent reports have indicated that a few former military officers have joined the terrorist groups. The numbers are reportedly very small, but they could represent a threat to the government. CCTV's Adel El-Naruki was in Cairo and filed this report.
Islamic militant groups wanted to make sure the fact former military officers join it is no secret. Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, a Sinai-based group, has published two videos of one of them discussing operations he has conducted. Among them was the assassination of former Interior Minister Muhammad Ibrahim last year. Waleed Badr was sacked from the armed forces several years ahead of these operations, but analysts believe his appearance in military uniform sends a strong message.
This is what we call an attempt to export terror. They want to give the impression that armed forces is divided. Its troops could join jihadi groups, which could help them in future recruiting processes. They want to tell the government your own people are targeting your ministers.
In the last decade, however, around two former military and three former police officers have become known to turn to Islamic extremism. All of them were dismissed of their duties long time before they joined these groups.
Egypt is concerned of the media coverage this concept has been gaining, concerned of the idea that the Arab world and the international community would get this impression. Egypt has a military intelligence organization that is extremely strict. We've never seen indication that the Egyptian army is divided or that some of its officers decided to form another army, like what happened in Syria. So this is not a trend. They are just a few anomalies to a strong established system.
President Anwar el-Sadat was assassinated by a group of military officers on duty. That was the first time Egypt realized the threat of extremist Islam on its armed forces. Since then, strict measures have been taken, trying to early detect officers with extremist tendencies and relieve them of duty. The number of military officers joining extremist groups could be non-significant, but their former military experience gives them advantage. They can easily comprehend and develop the military training of these groups. making them more effective than other recruits. Adel Mahroui, CCTV, Cairo.
Terrorist groups are finding new ways to raise funds for their activities, according to a senior UN official that's dealing with the issue. The groups, which include ISIL in Syria and Iraq, Al-Qaeda affiliates in Yemen, and Boko Haram in Nigeria, are widely known for the atrocities they commit against civilians. Jean-Paul Laborde is the executive director of the Security Council Counterterrorism Committee. He's attending the 13th UN Congress on Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice in Doha, Qatar. He spoke with journalist Jorge Millares outside the Congress.
This is not new that the terrorist group are financed. And we had already many means that we have discovered in this financing of terrorism, especially linked to what we call blacking, I would like to say, taking funds from the civil society, but also money laundering. Those were the traditional forms of financing of terrorism. But now we see new forms of financing, calls for donation by internet, not so easy to detect. Also, you have the natural resources, oil or other resources, even agriculture, for example, resources in the areas which are under the administration of the terrorist organizations, or even taxes of for the population. With the new phenomenon of the foreign terrorist fighters also bring with them the funds necessary for allowing the terrorist organizations to survive. So there is a variety now of new funding that the international community has to counter. And still, of course, the criminal justice has a role to play in that.
Here in the Congress, it's been cited the emerging crimes are being discussed, and you have mentioned the internet. What other manifestations of terrorism are associated to cybercrime specifically?
There is not only internet, which is a manifestation of cyberterrorism because of the use of internet, but now, you know, there are also the infrastructures which can be tackled by terrorist organizations. I've seen, for example, the media infrastructures like TV5, which has been attacked and hacked by terrorist organizations. This phenomenon is, of course, extremely dangerous, and I think that the international community has really started to work on it. And we at the Security Council, we have already taken action on it, and this is something that we work very closely with journalists, reporters, civil society, private companies with which we have to work very closely to counter this mechanism.
What can the UN and the international community do to stop the financing and the kind of actions that you have just mentioned?
The UN, and especially the Security Council, which always is the first body to react, has really taken very seriously this financing of terrorism. In September 2014, there was a summit of the Security Council, which is very rare, and the Council has taken a resolution, which is called Resolution 2178, in which all the parameters concerning the criminalization of this type of new financing are taken into consideration, but also the international cooperation and the exchange of intelligence among all the countries. And I really think that it is one of the major texts taken under Chapter 7 of the Charter, which means that the countries are obliged by these mandatory measures to implement, and we are here at the Executive Directorate to help in the implementation of this text. Concerning the second one, cyber, we really feel that we should at least have soft guides, because of course to legislate at the international level on this issue is extremely complicated, but still we should be able to promote guides on how to deal with this matter and how to react in an immediate way. When you speak about cybercrime, you also speak about infringing human rights, because this is always linked to privacy or personal human rights.
You were mentioning Resolution 2178, and all of them are binding resolutions, are mandatory. However, do you perceive a political willingness among member states to establish the required cooperation to tackle this issue?
Yes, of course. The fact that you had more than 126 states, including the head of state of Qatar, who participated in this summit It's really the manifestation of the will of member states to work on that. And we have received a lot of requests from member states on these issues. And we at CTED have been mandated by the Counterterrorism Committee of the Security Council to produce very soon a study on the magnitude of the phenomenon and how the international community can react state by state in terms of counterterrorism measures to this phenomenon. So we take that phenomenon as representative of the Council very seriously.
Russia is apparently accelerating its pivot to Asia in earnest this week, while Moscow's foreign and defense ministers were meeting with their counterparts from Beijing. Russia's prime minister made a landmark trip to Vietnam and Thailand. Andrew Karibko and Sergei Strokin are the co-hosts of the radio program Red Line from the Russian news agency RIA Novosti. They discussed some of the details of the new relationships that Moscow is developing in the world's largest and busiest market.
In an article entitled Vietnam and the Zen of Juggling, written by M.K. Bhadrakumar and carried by Asia Times, the former Indian diplomat writes, "Indeed, the Eurasian Union is the same baby that former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, in a fit of anger, once vowed to strangle in its cradle. She had said, 'We, the U.S., know what it is, and we are trying to figure out effective ways to slow down or prevent it.' Clinton saw the EEU as an invidious move by President Vladimir Putin to, quote, re-Sovietize the region. The remarks back in December 2012 sound ominous today against the backdrop of the regime change in Ukraine. The article continues by saying, 2015 becomes an anniversary year for both the U.S. and Russia. It is the 20th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Vietnam, and the 65th anniversary of the diplomatic ties between Russia and Vietnam. The visit by Medvedev and USS Fitzgerald were occasioned by their respective anniversary celebrations. This was smart thinking by Hanoi, which enables it to raise diplomatic toasts with Moscow and Washington simultaneously, year after year, till eternity."
Well, Andrew, absolutely. We are having extremely dramatic developments taking place in Asia-Pacific. And obviously, they should be taken into the context of that overlapping pivot to Asia, because we have President Obama's pivot to Asia politics. We have President Putin's pivot to Asia politics. So that all reminds me of my old younger days when I was a student. And I remember how Professor Bondarevsky was looking on the world map and says, "Look, students, those who control Indian Ocean control the whole world." So just to reformulate what he was saying is, I would say that in the 21st century, those who control Asia-Pacific control the whole world. Everybody understands that Asia is a locomotive, but who is going to drive this locomotive? That's the main question.
Actually, yeah, I think that is a very, very important question right now. I'd like to address that to our in-studio guest, Mr. Kirill Kokhtish, an associate professor at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations. Who is going to drive the locomotive of growth in the Asia-Pacific? Would it be Russia? Would it be the U.S.? Could you maybe see China having some very predominant influence? What's your take on this?
Well, you see, if it will take the latest development, we can tell that neither United States nor Russia would drive this locomotive, but BRICS Union probably will be able to do this, because actually there is high level of coordination between this union, which initially, as was a joke, was created by financial players, but then it turned into a real union, which coordinates economic policy and even practical policy, international policy. So probably this is switch of the balance of the power would be in favor of the BRICS countries, in my opinion, in the nearest year and a half, or even a bit more longer term.
Well, it really does seem like it could be. And in terms of a switching balance and everything, I'm wondering if this overlapping of pivots, the overlapping of Russia and the U.S.'s pivot to Asia, if this means that this new Cold War, as some experts call it, is expanding to yet another theater.
Oh, well, we can speak in these terms as well, in terms of the new Cold War, but also in terms of the when one superpower is losing control over part of the world and another superpower, I will call these superpower big countries, start to seize to control over more and more places. So that means that union with Asia, union between a free trade zone between Eurasian Union and Vietnam is a strong step forward, because it maintains strong ties, economic ties, between Vietnam and all the post-Soviet countries that made the Eurasian Union. I mean, Russia, Kazakhstan, Belarus, and Armenia. So this is science, clear science of growth.
Yes, and just as a follow-up to what Mr. Kokhtish says, I think that we have to underline what was important reason which actually accelerated Russia's that pivot to Asia policy, Western sanctions. We had to look for alternative markets. We have to look for alternative support. And this is actually why we've seen that, say, Premier Medvedev was the first Russian prime minister to visit Thailand in 25 years. Can you imagine?
Yeah, well, I think that in hindsight, we may see that the Western sanctions unintentionally could have created a break in Western control over the Asia-Pacific region.
The Democratic Party has become a desert where nothing grows. Nothing, that is, except the 1%'s hold on the party machinery. That, according to Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford, who offered this commentary after the official announcement this past weekend of the presidential campaign of Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Hillary Clinton just announced that she's running for president. However, this commentary is not really about her. It's about a nation of more than 300 million people in which politics has become the sole property and domain of the rich. The rich decided some time ago that Hillary Clinton would be the virtually unchallenged presidential candidate of the Democratic Party. The 48% of Americans that express an affinity with the Democratic Party have not yet chosen Clinton. There has been no primary election in any state, but that does not matter because the selection process that counts occurs in the boardrooms and mansions and private clubs and getaways of the rich. Hillary Clinton and her husband, Bill, have spent virtually their entire adult lives on the millionaire's campaign circuit, the rich man's primary. In the process of pleasing the rich, they have become rich themselves. Hillary hopes to spend $2.5 billion of mostly rich people's money in the 2016 campaign. Wealthy people will be just as generous with the Republican candidate. The outcome on Election Day is absolutely certain. The rich man's candidate will definitely win, and the people will lose, because they have no candidate in the major parties. The people aren't even in the game. The contest is over before the Democratic Party's formal selection process even begins. And when primary season does arrive, it will only be a formality. The menu has already been printed, and Hillary will be the main course for Democrats next year. Democratic voters can say yes to Hillary, but they can't say no, because the party machinery and the rich men who pay for that machinery will crucify and expel any Democrat who seriously challenges her from the left. The Democratic Party's apologists like to call it a big tent with room for blacks and browns and gays and labor and peace-loving people. But it's actually a huge trap designed to contain and politically neutralize the folks who might otherwise turn against the rich. The party has always been a scam, but at least in the old days it put on a populist show to fool the rank and file into believing that they could actually influence the party's direction. However, Wall Street is determined that there will be no serious democratic deviation from the corporate agenda set by Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton would represent the third Clinton presidency, which, for Wall Street, is just as good as the two George Bush presidencies. Maybe better, because labor and blacks and that fuzzy cohort called liberals will all think they won the election, when nothing could be further from the truth. Rank-and-file Democrats will see the fait accompli of Hillary's nomination as a sign of unity among Democrats, when in fact it is the triumph of filthy rich campaign contributors. The rich have shown great solidarity in uniting behind a Democratic presidential candidate. Later on, they will unite around a Republican candidate, too. And after that, it won't matter who wins. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.